Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. It's your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 30th of June, 2013, from the country of Flanders to the west of Brussels in the rotten heart of Europe. This is Nav Briefing number 73, entitled Where the Nightmare Ends. I've decided on that title rather than When the Nightmare Ends because I couldn't possibly say when the nightmare ends. Those of you in the Gaia Navigation Experiment who are living in the sacred narrative and who follow the special sophisticated timing parameters of this experiment realize that we are approaching a definitive minute in the nightmare, a definitive moment. It takes 10 seconds of aeonic time for the Aeon Sophia to establish the initial conditions of her correction. Those 10 seconds, 10 to 11 seconds, transpire from March 2011 to the 1st of May 2014. So the 1st of May 2014 is a definitive moment in the nightmare. The nightmare does not end at that moment. I would not make any predictions of when the nightmare ends. But the conditions for the intervention of the Aeon Sophia in the nightmare, as well as the conditions for the optimal participation of some human animals in her correction, will have been fully established at that moment, by that moment. As I've been living through the days here on my visit, taking a lot of time where I am now in the grenier, that is to say the attic, or the place where the grain would have been stored, in the grenier that I converted to a writing studio with my elegant Finnish wood stove that burned ferociously for many winters, many, many rainy seasons in Belgium, as I slept, wrote, dreamed, contemplated, reflected in this place of refuge, which has been my safe and happy home in Europe. I've reflected a lot on where to go next. I'm kind of tentative about how to handle this 70 series. I don't want to make the mistake that I have made sometimes in the past of introducing a theme and then not providing the adequate follow-up of that theme, plowing over freshly planted ground. I don't want to make those kind of mistakes at this moment. It would be my pleasure to be as impeccable as I can be right now, considering what I'm facing. But for that reason, I tentatively designate Nav Briefing 73, Where the Nightmare Ends, as part one. And there may be several parts of this during the time I'm in Belgium, several installments of NB73 before I proceed further into the 70s series and hit those crucial topics of the beauty of Persephone and reincarnation, which are, by the way, closely related topics, as remote as that may seem. So what next? What now? What today? I'd like to start by focusing your attention on three factors in the nightmare. Let's call them the breakpoints of the nightmare. Unless these factors are seen and resolved, the nightmare cannot end. So since I have adopted this generic theme for this series of talks, within the 70s group. I think it would be good to set out clearly at the outset the three breakpoints in the nightmare facing humanity, which is identical to the lucid dream in which the Aeon Sophia is now awakening. The first breakpoint concerns the riddle of why the Anthropos strain tends to turn against its environment. Remember that in episode 4, I believe it was, just before her plunge from the Pleroma, the Aeon Sophia, in the company of the other generators in the Pleroma, observed the Anthropos strain spreading like a mycelium of fine filaments, like a mycelium web of filaments, into the reaches of the arms of our galaxy. And as those mycelium threads proceeding from the Orion Nebula reached certain emergent planetary worlds, they found some of those worlds suitable for habitation, suitable for the life of the Anthropos. And so the Anthropos strain, nested in the Orion Nebula, seeded itself in 9 different planetary laboratories prior to the one we currently inhabit. Those planetary laboratories, however, were different from the Earth, and of course you know why. The sacred narrative explains the difference. Those 9 planetary worlds where the Anthropos found a favorable condition to evolve into a humanoid form, more or less like ourselves, did not have an aeon in imminent materiality with the planet. They were simply planetary worlds that arrived from the autonomous and independent conditions that pertain in the planet, in the limbs of the galaxy, in the spiral arms. Worlds arise, worlds dissolve. The mills of the gods grind slow, but they grind exceeding fine. The armature of the galactic limbs of a lenticular spiral is one of the mills of the gods. And so the aeons from the Pleroma, along with Sophia, observed how in these 9 experiments of Anthropos 1 through 9, variants of the self-same genomic plasm nested in M42, they observed how the experiments crashed because the Anthropos creature turned against its environment. Now, the human species living on the planet Earth today is in the 10th experiment. This is the 10th strain of the generic Anthropos plasm. So, Anthropos 10. And Anthropos 10 is doing the same thing that Anthropos 1 through 9 did, turning against its environment. And we have yet to come to a clear definition of why this happens. So one of the objectives of the Gaian Navigation Experiment in the remaining 10 or 11 months will be to arrive together at a descriptive syntax within the framework of the sacred narrative that explains explicitly and concretely how that comes about. As I've said, so far we have a clue to that, don't we? Additional to the calibration of the 7 elements of the Anthropos plasm, which need to be constantly reviewed and revised and updated, in addition to those 7 elements in the calibration of the Anthropos, there is an 8th element called sattva, that is the factor of rhythm. And in some manner, rhythm is a key to how to what causes the anthropos to turn against its environment. So this is a momentous clue. It's a key plot factor in the sacred narrative that is evolving and developing as the experiment unfolds. And I assure you, my friends, that this experiment is not abstract, and it does not involve metaphysical propositions, nor does it depend upon or promise metaphysical resolutions. I assure you that if it is possible to arrive at the descriptive syntax of what actually goes wrong with the experiment in that respect, in that one respect I'm discussing now, it simultaneously becomes possible to do something about it. And to do something about it effectively, consistently, concretely, and immediately. So that's a hopeful prospect, if you want to use the accursed word hope in any reference whatsoever, which I prefer not to do. That is a realistic prospect within the framework of the GNE. Okay, breakpoint number two. In the interim talk introducing the present talk, I put out the word phantasm and its equivalent, egregore. The fact is that when the imaginative faculty of the human animal does not operate in coevolution and collaboration with the imagination of the mother goddess, it becomes demented. There is no other option. There is no middle way. There is no compromise solution. There is no innocent form of narcissistic indulgence in the power of your imagination. You don't have that privilege. No one does. No human animal has the privilege for narcissistic indulgence with the power of imagination. Either your imagination is aligned to the dreaming of the wisdom goddess and operates in the framework of her story, or it is demented. Now, it may be demented in a relatively benevolent way, like a benign tumor, or it may be demented in a malevolent way. So there you have it. There's a definition for you. An egregore is a malevolent tumor in the imagination of the human species. I think that's a great analogy. That's a great metaphor. And following the method of Idris, well, what do you make of that, Mimedes? The metaphor or metaphoric value of that syntax and the literal value need to be considered equivalently. So if I say that an egregore, like the military-industrial complex, or the NSA, or Monsanto, is a malignant tumor in the human imagination, then I mean that metaphorically, but I also mean that it is literally so. How can that be so? Can only be so if human imagination has a living and material reality, and indeed it does. The medium of human imagination is the same as the medium of Sophia's imagination. Do you know what that medium is? That is the medium that is inside your body now and outside it at the same time. That is the medium that is inside you and in which you are simultaneously. That is the medium of the atmosphere, the livable atmosphere of the earth, with its unique and precarious homeostatic composition of 80% nitrogen, 20 to 21% oxygen, a minute percentage of argon, a minute percentage of carbon dioxide, and a minute, very minute percentage of hydrogen. Although hydrogen is one of the key components in water, which is a massive part of the biosphere. So the power of human imagination is such that it can infect the very biosphere with phantasms and egregores that operate in the nature of malignant tumors. How's that for a nightmare? How's that for a nightmare scenario? And this is the brutal reality of it. And so the next second breakpoint is dissolving those tumors, dissolving the egregores. The nightmare cannot end until that happens. Now, fortunately, following the rule of Idris, you have the option to consider a couple of ways to go about that if you would care to commit yourself to that particular mission, okay, of dissolving the egregores. One, of course, is to go directly against the material and literal manifestation of the egregore, to take on Monsanto and take down Monsanto. And how would you take down Monsanto? Well, I would say take it down from the top, if you get my drift. Those human animals who behave as the blind agencies of these egregores are part of this malignancy on the planet. They are part of the affliction that torments the anthropos and that threatens the beauty and harmony of this experiment. On the other hand, if you don't like that option, if you don't know how to handle a sniper rifle, well, we can consider what to do with the egregores at the level of their archetypal and psychological existence, as it were. There is a war happening on this planet. The Third World War is well underway and has been underway from the very moment of the end of the Second World War. And the Third World War is a war for the mind and a war in the mind, and it is a psychological war. You know, a while ago I advised that you view that documentary called Who is Elisa Lam? I don't know if anything is going to come of that or if those young people are going to get their act together. I don't see how they can get their act together, honestly, if they don't have planetary tantra and if they don't know what we know and don't have the tools of the Shakti cluster and Gaian tantric magic. How are they going to fight a psychological war against microwave weapons? Nevertheless, that is a front. You can place yourself on that front. You can commit yourself to seeing these egregores and taking them down and dissolving them. That is the battle of the hero against the monster, an archetypal theme, hero versus monster. But you know, even the theme of the hero has evolved. It's evolved enormously. In fact, the old model or paradigm of the hero versus the monster, about which I wrote extensively in my book, The Hero, well, doesn't really apply anymore. The monsters to be defeated today are phantasms of the anthropos itself. And that was not always the case in the past. So these myths evolve, and the myth themes transmutate over many centuries, which is something that you can only appreciate when you have an intimate knowledge of the dynamics of myth making. But take my word on it, that is how it operates, that is how it works. Finally, we come to breakpoint number 3. This is it gets more difficult. I'm not going to say I'm sorry. I'm just going to say I'm in the same boat with you. It's extremely, extremely difficult to face these breakpoints. And the third one is without question the greatest challenge facing humanity. And that concerns the right use of the capacity of the human animal to commit lethal violence. We are so far off the mark in understanding the nature of violence in our own species that it is quite possible that this third breakpoint is unreachable. And were that to be the case, then the nightmare is not going to end until the end of this kalpa, until she wakes from the dream and everything that you know as reality disappears as if a film were broken while you're watching a movie and suddenly you're looking at a blank screen, which is called, in the old Sanskrit terminology, the pralaya. So, there we are. Those are some opening remarks. Certainly, those points are focal points and talking points in this GNE for the remainder of the experiment. So, I ask you to observe them and preserve them indelibly in your minds. Now, proceeding from here, how about I follow up on my promise, if you will, that I was going to offer a little travelogue while I'm up north and give you some impressions. And you can conclude for yourself how these impressions reflect on the current status of the nightmare of history and the lucid dream of the Aeon Sophia. I've had many, many impressions over the last 5 or 6 days. It's terribly poignant for me to be here in this place with my single oldest friend and best friend in Europe. You know, a Nahual has no attachments, you know that. Nahual has no personal attachments. But there are always exceptions to every rule. Our beloved mother, goddess, herself is an exception, isn't she? And so I can tell you that this Nahual does have 3 attachments of a personal kind. 2 of them are to 2 cats, and the third is to a funny little Belgian woman. So it's very poignant for me to be in the presence of my attachments and to be reminded of the transience of life and the ultimate emptiness of desire. Or as I prefer to say, in the mood of Kala Tantra, the union of desire and emptiness. That's where I am right now. And what is also poignant to me about this place is that it's absolutely saturated with memories and moments. I know pretty much every corner, every road, every farm, every little pasture with cows and horses, with sheep, donkeys, chickens, geese, goats, the countryside of West Flanders around Belgium, and I know Belgium and around Brussels, and I know Brussels by heart and everything around it and all the way out to the coast and up to the Netherlands and over to Köln, Germany, down to Switzerland, across to Paris, to Bretagne, down to the Dordogne. I can hover over it like an eagle, and I guess I am a sort of eagle for Europe. So when I find myself down on the land and walking around, it's pretty poignant. And there are so many things I could tell you about. I just want to give you two small incidents that you might find revealing. You know, when I was here building the Grenier, every inch of it by my own hand, every single feature, every bookshelf, every feature of the ceiling, I put in the false ceiling in the high peaked roof of the house and so forth. I spent a lot of time down the road at the Brico Center, Brico being short for bricolage, being the French word for do-it-yourself. So I'm an ace among my titles as Turton and Nahual and whatever, you know. I'm also an ace at Brico or bricolage. And so I went back to the Chaussée de Mons, which is a main road that runs through this quarter of the suburbs of Brussels into the city. And this quarter of the suburbs of Brussels, which borders on the Flemish village, is a really shabby sort of white trash, lower middle class area. There are very expensive and elite areas and enclaves or communes around Brussels, communities such as Uccle and Ixelles and those places, and diplomatic communities where people live in great luxury and privilege in great mansions. But this is not the case here. This is really lower middle class, a lot of Turkish and Moroccan immigrants and that sort of thing. And so there's the Brico Center where I used to go, the do-it-yourself place, the huge place where I would wheel in there and get tools and get wood and things. And off to the side of it, it's in what is called the Grand Surface, which is the French term for a shopping mall, a big surface. And that Grand Surface has a couple of other places, which is contingent to the do-it-yourself depot, which are a supermarket, and a Media Markt, which is a big place where they sell computers and IT stuff. So I go there, and what do I find? I find that familiar facade of the do-it-yourself depot has been transformed. And the supermarket next to the depot has also been transformed. And instead of being what they were in the past, which you could say was functional and compatible to the demographics around here and compatible to the economics around here, instead of being like that, it's all been upscaled. So lo and behold, in the front of the do-it-yourself depot, there is a new facade, all glass and metal, and there are four or five boutiques selling clothes, and I don't mean cheap clothes either, and selling cosmetics, you know, boutiques. Boutiques are shops that sell things that people don't need and generally can't afford. There's a line of boutiques there now, and the entrance to the Brico is like off to the left. It's just a small entrance, and the Brico is still there where it was, the vast depot, but it's behind this facade of these boutiques. And then off to the left, where there used to be a shabby cafe, most things in Belgium are pretty shabby, I can tell you that, there used to be a shabby little cafe where you could stop and get a coffee when you were coming or going from doing your errands in the supermarket. has been broken open into a courtyard. There are potted plants, and it's been dressed up like a yuppie cafe. So, and the supermarket itself has been converted from a low economy supermarket, that is to say, lower working class level economy demographics, to some kind of upscale place, which is more like the chic supermarkets that you find in Brussels, in the quarters where the parasites of the European community live, where they can go in and spend, I'm not kidding, €450 on groceries for a weekend. And suddenly there's this Delhaize, it's the franchise, upscale supermarket, totally new, spanking new. I walked in there. I can tell you that the rayon, what am I going to say, the aisle that had sauces and dressings on it was 20 feet long and 5 levels high. Just sauces and dressings. I can tell you that there was a lobster aquarium at the end over where they sell the meat and the fish with 2 live lobsters in it. Who in the fuck living in this area of Brussels is going to be eating lobsters at €40 a pop? And so I was staggered. I was standing there with my friend, Chantal, thinking, my jaw was hanging down. I said, you know, what's this? You know, it's this upscaling to like what we in America would call a yuppie level. And this, like I say, this kind of yuppie cafe atmosphere in front of the supermarket and these boutiques. And who's going to go in these places? Who's going to frequent this cafe? Who's going to buy these things? Who's going to buy lobsters? Who's going to buy those lobsters? And I just stood there scratching my head. I'm saying, this is all pretending. This is just pretending. They're acting as if somebody's going to come. They're acting as if there is an economy to support this facade. And it reminded me of this clip I saw on YouTube. I think it was placed in Belfast, Ireland, where the individual who made the clip was saying, hey, you know, I live in a really rundown area of Belfast and the economy is crap and we're all poor. But the other day I came out of my house and I looked, started walking down the street and I saw in the block ahead of me all these new shops and everything. And I thought, wow, finally we're getting, somebody's putting some money into the neighborhood. We're going to get some commerce here. People have jobs. And the guy walks down and there are no new shops. It's just photographs. Life-size photographs of upscale boutiques. So they didn't even bother to install the boutiques in Belfast. They just put the photographs of them. I mean, is this the consummation of the work of the archons or what? So I was really struck by this, returning to this place where I've been thousands of times and bought everything, including the chair I'm sitting in here, the desk that my computer is on. Everything in this attic, which I renovated over a number of years, came from that do-it-yourself depot, which is now embedded in some kind of phony upscale economic scenario. The insanity of it is enough to take your breath away. Now just going to take you on my wings, okay? The eagle, the American eagle who flies over Europe, is going to take you on my wings and we're going to fly away from the shopping center about no more than 3 or 4 miles to the west. And you're in the countryside of Flanders and we're going to set down in a little village, not far from the village where I am right now. The name of that village is Flemish, but it translates in English into something like Misty Creek. It's a tiny little village. And there, each Saturday, among the flat fields where are planted the corn and potatoes and wheat and sugar beets and linen, among those flat fields of Flanders, there's a tiny little town square, probably about a quarter of the size of an average city block. And there, each Saturday, there's a market. So I went to the market on Saturday with my friend. And there you can buy some really good organic vegetables that come from nearby farms. And I mean, they're really good. They are completely grown organically. There's no chemicals in them whatsoever. You can also buy some really good meat, some really good chicken. If you're a meat eater, this is a place where you can get some of the best meat prepared by artisans and people who know how to handle dead animals, if you will, the flesh of dead animals. And there are, of course, they sell ice cream. Europeans consume an enormous amount of ice cream. And they sell pastries. And I went there not only because I wanted to drop in on the local market, which I hadn't gone to for many years, but I wanted to get a maton. Now, a maton is a specialty of this part of Belgium. And it's something like, I don't know what to compare it to. It's round. It's about, like, say, the size of a large donut, but it's not a donut, it's a muffin. But it's a very special kind of muffin, a maton. First of all, it's round and it's crimped around the edges. And it's baked in such a way that it's softly baked and the top of it has a layered crust, which is delicate and flaky. And the contents of the maton is a kind of mixture of flour and egg and vanilla. And so the maton is baked in such a way that outside it's just slightly crispy and crusty with this very delicate layers, these delicate layers, paper thin layers. And you bite into that, and then inside is this kind of filling. It's not like a custard filling because it is baked flour and egg, but it's just baked to the point where it remains moist and it has the most delicious vanilla flavor. That's a maton. So I went to get my maton at the local Saturday market. And there weren't many people there. I can tell you that years ago, it would be jammed. You couldn't get near the place. There were not many people there in that little square on Saturday. The Flemish people, you know. I have to say this. Believe it or not, there is fondness behind what I'm saying. But they're not exactly the prettiest bunch of critters that ever were born upon the earth. You really think when you're among these Flemish people, and some of these Dutch and Belgian people, that you're in a Bruegel scene, that you're maybe even in a Boss scene, who knows. But certainly they're Bruegel-esque. They're Smurfs. They're dwarfish. They're not pretty. They're trolls that crawled out from under some mushroom. And there they were, these simple, humble people. What's not humble about them are their pretenses to materiality and their cars. You want to see cars. You're out here in the hinterlands of Flanders, in the farmlands. You want to see cars. You want to see luxury 4x4 BMWs, Mercedes up the wazoo, Volvos, you know. It's a thing of prestige among the bourgeois, and these people are bourgeois, even though they're bourgeois rooted in the farmlands. They have bourgeois materialist values, and you want to see them show that in the cars they drive. It's incredible. They have really expensive cars, and it's a status symbol. So here are all these expensive cars, and here are all these trollish, kind of like shabby, unattractive people sitting around, mingling in this market. And it just so happens that on this occasion, there was an orchestra, and I'd never seen this before. There was a community orchestra playing, sitting at tables in the center of the market square and playing. And I stood there and looked at them, and I have to tell you that it was incredibly poignant to look at this and to know what I had just seen a couple of days before, no more than 4 miles away. And both scenes are in the nightmare. There's no escape from the nightmare. It just gets in your face more in some places than in others. And both scenes are in the nightmare. This little market is hanging on by a thread. Doesn't thrive in the way it did 4, 5, 6, 10, 15 years ago. And yet here are these people who obviously are not being paid, who volunteered to come with their shiny brass instruments, set up the electric keyboard, set up the drums, and play really kind of nice music. You know, not kitsch. A lot of European culture is kitsch. Oh, this is not kitsch. No, it was charming. And I sat there, or I stood there, and I just thought, you know, this is the human animal. Take a good look. It's like people still want to do things for nothing. People still want to do things just for the pleasure of doing it and for an act of generosity on its own sake that does not seek a reward. This is the mark of a true human animal. It's gotten pretty bad with Phantopos. I don't have to tell you that. It's been years now since I would not cry anymore when I see cruelty. Or I would not cry when someone is cruel to me or someone harms me. I cry when someone shows me an act of kindness. That's how far it's gone. And I felt like crying that standing there. So he got into the car and we drove back through the fields. And I did as I've often done and let my eyes scan over these flat fields of Flanders. There's something consoling about the humility and the homeliness of this country. And there's something incredibly powerful and poignant about the way that the light of the sky comes down and touches the land. It comes right down and kisses the land. And it's like the kiss of a magnificent beauty upon a humble and homely face. And we're driving through these fields, and you see where you see the ground is plowed up, and the ground here, the earth here, looks like massive plains of chocolate. Some of it looks like milk chocolate, and some of it looks like chocolat fondant, cooking chocolate, black chocolate. And you see this land plowed up, and you see this furrows of chocolate. And if you look really closely, as you're driving by, sort of tilting your head down a little bit to the level of the land, you can see that there's a sheen of light that comes off this chocolate earth. And it's a sheen of magenta. It has a magenta sheen, almost a magenta iridescence. This is an uncanny property of the earth in the flatlands of Flanders. Well, so much for my little travelogue, or the episode that I can share with you in this briefing. Now I'm going to devote the remaining half an hour of the briefing to the pertinent topics that float in the present moment of the Gaia navigation experiment. The topics that float in your first and second attention. So in that vein, I'm going to title this first installment of NB73, Where the Nightmare Ends, subtitle it, Phantasms of the Anthropos. And I just want to see if I can make some observations about the egregores produced by human imagination when it is divorced from the dreaming of the Earth Goddess. Some observations that are fresh and new and novel, that may resonate closely to things you already know, but will perhaps somehow enliven or intensify those insights. You know, I've said that the battle for correction, the battle that ensues during the correction of the Aeon Sophia, is a battle for the narrative. That control of the narrative will determine the outcome of the battle. That is to say, it will determine the fate of humanity. No less than that. And it will determine the outcome of this divine experiment for this eonic day of 26,000 years. For this eonic cycle. But not the ultimate and final fate of the Anthropos, of course. Even while Anthropos 10 is going under, the Aeon Sophia is transmuting from within the experiment, transmuting humanity toward its future expression as Anthropos 11. Remember the central riddle of correction. What is the difference between the way the Aeon Sophia would intervene in this experiment had she not plunged, and the existing conditions of her plunge? What is the difference? Well, one of the big differences, as you know, is that she is able to induce the transmutation of the future expression of the Anthropos, that is, Anthropos 11. She is able to induce that transmutation, what I called back in May 2000, when I got the first proto-terma in Arc in France, what I called transspeciation. She is able to effectuate and induce transpeciation from Anthropos 10 to Anthropos 11 from within the experiment itself, and that is not the case, would not have been the case, had she not plunged into material immanence. As I stated in setting up the initial conditions of this experiment, the initial terms, you can observe how the Aeon Sophia induces the transmutation of Anthropos 11 from the very living behavior, from the living and immediate and present behavior of Anthropos 10, from the placement and timing of the lunar perigee, divine alchemy. And you can observe and follow and participate in how she manages the events in her own dreaming, including what we call the nightmare of human history, by observing the placement and timing of the lunar apogee. Now, the narrative that runs the world today totally excludes the conception of the Anthropos that comes down to the world from the Gnostic visionaries. And it totally excludes the Aeon Sophia itself. It looks like I'll be doing an interview tomorrow. And I also got a request from Coast to Coast just yesterday to do an interview. So I'm going back to some interviews now. But I'm going back in a different way and taking a different approach than I did previously, having had a break for a while. And one of the things that I intend to address in my interviews, in almost all my interviews, is the problem of the lies that human animals are told about humanity, the lies about humanity. The narrative that can change the way people live on this planet must be true. That is the absolute criterion. That is the absolute and fundamental criterion for a narrative that can lead to sanity and harmony and mutual aid and the thriving of this experiment. The narrative must be true. If the narrative that society follows is riddled with lies and deliberately implanted with lies, then all you're going to get is evil, murder, exploitation, enslavement, corruption, and disaster. That's the only thing that can come from a narrative that is deliberately implanted with lies. And such is the current mainstream narrative. Everywhere you look, there's nothing but lies. But what I intend to do with you right now, as a preview to my previous interviews, or to my upcoming interviews, and a departure from my previous ones, is to concentrate on two lies. To see these two lies and overcome them and get beyond them would be a great step in establishing the true narrative for our species and for life on this planet. The first lie is the lie that the material world is inert, that matter is not conscious, that matter is dumb. The lie says that the earth is made of dirt and rock, and dirt and rock are unconscious. Maybe we could give some kind of token, mystical New Age acknowledgement to the trees and the seas and the clouds, and maybe we could glorify ourselves by showing that we recognize that nature is alive. But it's just a token recognition, unless you know how it is alive, and unless you know who lives in that nature that you consider to be alive. You can look at someone sitting across from you in the room, a man sitting in a chair, you can say, he's alive. But who is that man? You really only know the living being when you know the identity. So I reject absolutely all token acknowledgments that the earth is alive. It's not enough. It doesn't break that lie. It simply puts a kind of coating around it. So the first lie is the lie that says that the material planet Earth is not just as alive as any animal living on the Earth, and that it is not conscious and self-conscious, sentient, that it does not have emotions and emotional responses, and in particular, the lie that says that it is impossible to communicate with the living organism of the earth in the way that you would communicate with another animal. That's all a lie. And a recent lie, I must say, but it's a big lie. The second lie that I want to address, and this relates, of course, to the question of the battle over the narrative, is the lie that says, well, we, the human species, don't really know where we came from. We don't know why we're here on this planet. We just ultimately don't know. We just ultimately don't know why the Earth exists and what we're doing here on it. And we cannot know. That's a lie. But that is a very prevalent lie. And even the people who would say that religion, which claims to answer those questions, why is the Earth here and what are we doing on the Earth, has failed. And even those who would admit that science equally has failed to answer those two questions end up holding the view that because religion has provided us with fraudulent answers and science has provided us with erroneous answers, that there must not be any real answer and that we can't really know how the Earth came to be and what we are doing on this planet. That's a huge lie. And so, obviously, the battle for the narrative depends upon overcoming those two lies. And that can only be done one person at a time. Every single person, every single human animal who recognizes in the Sophianic vision story the true biography of our planet that explains the origin of the human species, the presence of the Archons, the dilemma of humanity turning against its environment, and many, many other features of human reality. Those who can see that are already holding the power to change the narrative. It's not a quantitative process. But these two lies have to be confronted every time they come up, and confront them with everyone. Pick your battles, of course, carefully, but confront them on every occasion that you can. Now, how does this topic of lies relate to the phantasms of the Anthropos? Well, if you look at these egregores, like the NSA, FEMA, the European Community, the EU, you know, the European Union, or Monsanto, or McDonald's, for that matter. If you look at these egregores, you'll find that their organism, the organism of that phantasmic entity, is constructed of lies. These are the lies that have propagated in the human mind due to human use of imagination divorced from the imagination of the planet itself. And so the egregore is a tissue of lies. Monsanto is a tissue of lies. So there are a number of these egregores floating around the planet, and they're obviously horrible creatures. And you have to sit back and wonder, what are we going to do here? Are we going to all be like Don Quixote and go like Don Quixote jousting at windmills? Or we're going to go running headlong at these egregores, try to take them down. You know, what are we going to do? Well, it's a good question. I don't really have an answer. All I know is that dissolving these egregores, is necessary to get out of this nightmare. It's as simple as that. And yet, of course, that's not a satisfactory answer, is it? Because I'm really at the point here of painting a picture of an insurmountable problem. And I've been thinking a lot about this lately. And I've been thinking about the fact that it's probably game over for Anthropos 10. I would say most certainly it is game over for Anthropos 10. And so if you want to have a future with the planet, then you need to consider how to get into the current of transpeciation and offer yourself to the alchemical transmutation of the wisdom goddess, which is the secret of the number 666, by the way. So, those who follow the beast, those who revere and worship, to use the archaic terminology of religion, the powers of the beast and the scarlet woman, that dynamic composite of 18 powers, 7 heads, 10 horns, and the scarlet woman who rides the beast, 18 powers. Those who bond themselves to those powers, not to serve those powers, but to command them, put themselves in the transmutation toward Anthropos 11. And that may be where it ends up, folks. That may be the solution of the two-part solution of Sophia's correction. Part of the solution, to put it brutally, is that she takes some of the elements of those animals who enter transmutation ahead into the future kalpa, and she composts everything else. And the composting of Anthropos 10, well, you tell me. Do you think it's well underway? Remember, correction is diorthosis, which means two parts, two-part solution, diorthosis. So, let's take a few steps back now from this radical perspective that the nav is developing, and let's say, okay, suppose that I know and feel absolutely and intuitively certain, morally certain, morally consecrated, and dedicated with every grain of my being and the force of my highest desire to be in Sophia's divine alchemy and offer my life to her for transmutation to Anthropos 11. Suppose you do that. You're still living in the nightmare. You're still living on a battlefront. And my advice at that point would be to choose your battles carefully and to choose your battles on the basis of that which you would enjoy. on the basis of the pleasure you have in that battle. No one of us can tackle all these egregores of the Anthropos. It would be a magnificent feat in your life if you could just handle one of them. So choose one. And choose your battles in that respect, in this perspective that I'm presenting now. Now, we could all joke about this, and we could have an inside running joke in the GNE. We said, what's your favorite egregore? You know? And maybe you're linked, either in physical reality or through the virtual connections that we have on the internet. Maybe you're linked with another crew member who shares the same egregore as you. You know, the same egregore target as you. And I'll tell you that different people are going to be inclined to focus attention at the level of psychic and psychological warfare, to focus attention to bring down certain phantasms. Different people will have different preferences. Now, that's a pretty steep challenge to put in front of you, I know. And it might be preferable just to turn away, you know, just to ignore these monstrous phantasms. And I recognize the temptation to do that. So I think I would conclude this, and certainly one does not want to become obsessed with battling these monsters in such a manner that it destroys your life or ruins the pleasure of living, okay? Important qualification. So with that consideration in mind, I just would like to close this briefing with a statement of my personal commitment. You know, when I use the word anthropos as a Gnostic, I don't mean literally the population of human animals on the planet Earth. Even when I use the word humanity, I don't mean that it comprises the totality of human animals on this planet. Brutal reality of it is, a considerable number of human animals have lost their humanity. So if they've lost the quality of humanity and the properties and capacities of humanity, and if they do not behave from the intelligence of humanity and from the endowment of the anthropos, then what's left of their humanity? And what's left to save? My motivation, if it helps at all to know this, is certainly not to save humanity. And in many respects, as you know, I don't have a great fondness for the specimens of humanity that I encounter in the world today. I don't love everybody I meet just because they belong to the human species. Far from it. But to me, facing these phantasms of the anthropos is a commitment that comes from what I will call a solidarity with the anthropos, conceived as the primary subject of this experiment. And within that frame, within that syntax, the recognition that I am that subject. I am the subject of the experiment taking place on this entire planet. And anyone who joins me in that recognition is in solidarity with the Antipos. And that is a commitment that stands quite distinct, I would say, from the conventional notion of being committed to help or serve or save humanity. Those being terms which you will not find in the Navigator's syntax. So I would close on that note. We are still in the shift of Idris, at the hinge, in fact, as I make this recording. And at the hinge, there always comes a kind of solution or resolution, as you may recall. I sense a solution coming up in the last week of the Idris shift due to the apogee surge with the presence of Jupiter at the point of the surge, and that occurs on the 6th of July, in about a week from today. Still within the Idris shift. If you want to get your mind really, really clear on the difference between the conventional concept of humanity, if you will, and the Gnostic concept of the Antipos, then you have to understand that it's a participatory identity. You don't belong to it unless you participate with it in the primary function of its existence, in the primary purpose of its existence. Solidarity with the Antipos, which involves facing the phantasms that arise as a disease of human imagination. Solidarity with the Antipos depends on seeing that you to whom I speak, like myself, are the subject of this experiment. And you can set aside every possible conception and variation of self-importance that could be constructed by the human mind. Set them all aside. And in their place, put that recognition that you are the subject of this experiment, the primary subject. And you are in solidarity with everyone else who realizes that to be so. And in that solidarity is the true and enduring and deathless life of the Anthropos. Those of us who join now in that solidarity can change the fate of humanity. The entire human race doesn't have to wake up for its fate to be changed. That is an instruction from Idris. And with that thought, I will conclude this briefing.